This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Danger! Danger!
It's not a lineup, it's not an army, it's not a stable, and it's not a family. It's an alliance of businessmen.
Take a ride.
Place to Be Nation, you're listening to the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast, featuring a different way to look at and debate the history of wrestling. And now, your co-host, the PTBN PWO two-man power trip, JT and Will.
The Dangerous Alliance would rather die
than surrender to you.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 16 of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. I'm your co-host, JT, along with me, as always, my good friend, and that is good old Will from Texas. Will, how you doing?
Man, I've been better, man. You know, Lemmy died a couple of weeks ago, and I've just been thinking about Motorhead, man, just playing old Motorhead albums, and a little depressed. Holiday blues here.
Death has been a hot topic for us, mainly because we survived hell, a trip through hell, but we're all back here.
Yeah.
I think Basil has been reincarnated, hopefully. Dan McGinn, is he back alive and doing okay?
He is alive and kicking. He does not wear his holiday sweater, though, anymore. He kind of dug himself out of that, but we're still holding on strong to the holidays. The poinsettia is still up. We still have the stockings on the fake fireplace. It's a winter wonderland still up here.
Wow, even into 2016, Dan McGinn rocking the poinsettias. But that's how he rolls, sweater vests and poinsettias. And this is how we roll, Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. If you're new to the club, we go through the show. We have 30 minutes per game or challenge. We do three of those, and then we do some mail at the end. So what we usually do is Dan reads the game, introduces the rules, and then Will and I spend 30 minutes debating and arguing. So, Mr. McGinn, why don't you break in here, settle up, and tell us what is challenge number one.
Well, guys, it may be a happy new year, but we're going to go back to one of our old favorites. It's the Game of Thrones tournament. And this time around, we are going to pick the greatest manager of all time.
All right. So last time we did the Game of Thrones, we did great title changes, and that took us like three episodes to hack away through, I think, or two or three episodes. But this time, we're confident we can get it done in one, and we have chosen eight of the top managers in wrestling history, at least more towards the modern times. We didn't delve too far back. I don't think we ended up touching the golden shower trio. What are they called?
I don't know, man. But yeah, we didn't do the Grand Wizard. We didn't do Freddie Blassie. None of us were watching wrestling when those guys were relevant.
And I hate Lou Albano, so he wouldn't have been very moved.
Right, and so you know, it's we're basically doing the cable era.
Right.
So we
picked eight all together, and then Dan McGinn ranked them in his eyes, one through eight. And what we'll do is he will give us the matchups, tournament style. Will and I will debate who should advance, and if we have a tie, if we're split and we won't come to an agreement, which often happens, Dan already has the ready-made tiebreaker because we'll just go with the higher seed in his eyes because that'll be obviously who he thinks is better anyway. So, and we'll go from there. And I think at the end we can also talk about some maybe honorable mentions that didn't make the cut of the eight, but that were on the outside looking in that could have maybe been in if we expanded the field at all. So why don't we dive in, Dan? Why don't you tell us? I guess we'll start with the 1-8 matchup. We'll find out immediately who you think is the greatest manager of all time, and then who's the bottom of this group we have here.
Well, in our first matchup, it will be Bobby the Brain Heenan taking on Paul Ellering.
All right. So what else we can also do, Will, is maybe say if we agree or disagree with Dan's ranking. So of the eight guys we have here in the pool, without giving away any others, I'm confident saying Bobby would have probably been my number one. So I'm good there. And Ellering probably would have been around the bottom two. So.
I wouldn't have Ellering at the bottom two, but here's the thing I want to say about Paul Ellering. Yeah, Bobby Heenan wins this running away, so I just want to put that out there. But the thing I always liked about Ellering is that Ellering was a legitimate badass himself, right? You know, he was a former wrestler, body lifter, whatever. And he actually managed their business affairs. He was a real manager. And so I always liked that about Ellering, that he actually did manage their affairs. And that, so I want to give him just kind of a shout out, you know, for actually not just walking the walk and talking the talk, but for living the gimmick, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think part of my issue with him is, and this is just like my own mental block, I seem to always reward or give more credit to managers that had like either a bigger stable or a, you know, wider breadth of guys under their watch. And I feel like, you know, we're going to probably get this a little bit too with another guy later, but a guy like Ellering, you know, did he ever manage really anyone else? I know they had the larger Legion of Doom, like in Florida or whatever, but
In Georgia, they had King Kong Bundy and Jake the Snake and then the Road Warriors. So, yeah, he did manage a larger stable there, but he made their most money and had their most famous just the touring tag team.
Right, and then obviously DOA in the final days in the WWF. But so to me, that always took a little bit of a hit. Like I like the guys like a Bobby Heenan who had just this wide range, because to me that showed, and I think Ellering could have done this, but Heenan had such variety, and some of the other guys had such variety that they could believably manage a silent killer like Haku, a big crazy eyes monster like Andre the Giant, or you know, the smarmy, arrogant douchebag.
Oh, hold on. Did you just call Andre the Giant, the living legend, a big, crazy-eyed giant?
Well, like in his heel run he was when he was choking out Hulk Hogan and everything. Like, he was like always like bug-eyed and choking.
I didn't think he was crazy-eyed. I thought he looked, he looked really drunk and had like bloodshot eyes.
Well, I'm thinking, like, I guess the
one
that... He
looked half asleep.
The one that popped in my head because I just watched it is when he attacked Hogan on Saturday Night's Main Event when Hogan fought Bundy and Andre was like choking him madly and like with that suit jacket on. So whatever, big giant, angry giant. So and then the douchebags like Rick Rude and Mr. Perfect. Like he believably had this stable of guys that seemingly would have no other connection to each other because they had nothing in common, but made it all work because they were all the family, you know, or like maybe smart tacticians like the Brainbusters and the wild, crazy man like the Barbarian. So he just had this like great stable of forces, and he made it all work. And he was an asshole and a money grubber and a penny pincher. And, you know, he had the smartest business deal ever when he sold Andre to Ted DiBiase for $10,000 and or sold him for $100,000 and bought it back for $10,000. You know, made a lot of money on that deal. So a lot of,
cool moments. I lived through all of that stuff when it was going on. But you know what? To me, Bobby Heenan is synonymous with another guy we lost this past year, Nick Bockwinkel.
Yep, that too. Yes.
You know, for me, that's Bobby Heenan. That's two superior wrestling minds working off one another. And I was never really impressed with Bobby Heenan's WWF family. You know, to me, his candidacy hinges on that Nick Bockwinkel run, but easily a better manager than Ellering.
You know, do you think one of the managers could have worked with the Andre heel turn?
Well, out of the managers we have here, the ones they had available in WWF.
Let's go with the ones of, any in that were like existed in that time period, any promotion. You know what I mean? Like who?
Like Jim Cornette could have pulled off Andre the Giant. You know, Gary Hart definitely could have pulled
Gary
off.
Gary Hart was on my list, yep.
J.J. Dillon could have pulled off Andre the Giant.
Yep. I think those four are the big ones.
I think Jimmy Hart in Memphis could have, you know what I mean? Because you talk about family, Jimmy Hart's first family is the best run of all time. But he could have pulled it off if he was allowed to be Memphis Jimmy Hart, not WWF Jimmy. Hart's hard because there are two different Jimmy Harts.
Right, yeah, and WWF he was a lot more, you know, goofier, kind of. Not that he wasn't taken legitimately, he had some legit challenges and contenders, but he was always presented more as, like, the pipsqueak loudmouth. Whereas to me, Bobby, the Andre, like, if you watch the whole Andre thing happen, like, over the course of, like, the primetime wrestling and the superstars, a guy like Heenan is perfect, and you name the ones I was thinking, and that's Dillon and Gary Hart, because to me it takes like a even Cornette might have been too over the top for the Andre turn. Like, I feel like they needed like a calculating businessman kind of manager, and that's where Heenan, Dillon, and Gary Hart were more aimed towards, as the guys that were sneaky, hatching the plan, calm demeanor, but also kind of quick talker.
Ultimately, the reason that worked is because Bobby Heenan had been feuding with Hulk Hogan for 3 years straight or 2 years straight, if you go back to AWA, feuding with him back then too. So that's kind of why that works, right? Is not so much the Andre turn, which was important because, oh, that's my best friend, brother. But because it was Heenan who managed him.
Right. If you watch everything unfold with the Andre getting suspended as the Machines, and then mysteriously the suspension's dropped, and then, the slow build on Piper's Pit, Heenan was just the perfect, and like you said, because they had been feuding and he had been looking for that ace to finally take Hogan out. I think Dillon and Hart are the only guys I would say would have been just as successful with the kind of the slimy mastermind that was behind that whole thing. But I think we're both comfortable saying Bobby at least moves on over Paul Ellering, correct?
Sure. Ellering's gone.
All right, Dan. So what's the 4-5 matchup here?
Struggled with ranking both of these guys because I bet they'd be different on your guys' list. But our 4-5 matchup is J.J. Dillon taking on another Hart, Gary Hart.
Okay. I think, my mental list, I would say J.J.'s top four for me, so I'm fine with him at four. I know Will and I differ on one guy quite a bit, but and Gary Hart's a guy I haven't been exposed terribly much to. I know enough about him to know how good he was, but two feel right to me, but I know you might feel a little bit different.
Here's the thing about JJ was really good in his role, but to me, I always feel like the Horseman would have been every bit as successful with or without JJ Dillon.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree.
I thought him and Tully Blanchard worked really well together. Mm-hmm. I liked him as Tully's manager. But, Tully kind of had as much heat and had as much stuff to do with Baby Doll at his side.
Well, JJ with Buddy Landell was good, too, in those early...
Yeah, the 85.
Yeah.
And Buddy was there for a cup of coffee and he screwed it all up. The thing about Gary Hart, and I always love this about Gary Hart, is another guy who lived the gimmick. Like, got his head shaved, never grew his hair back. You know what I mean?
Right.
He was a perfect foil for the Von Erichs. And then in 89, I don't know if you remember this, he came back to WCW and led up the J-Techs with Muda and Funk and Buzz Sawyer.
Yep.
And so I always have a lot of... a personal attachment to Gary Hart. And I think that he was a more effective manager. I thought JJ was great in his role. I just always, maybe I'm selling Dillon a little bit short because I'm not really up on his Florida work. Okay. When he was feuding with Dusty, but I'm going to go Gary Hart here.
Yeah. I'm not going to argue too hard. I mean, I love JJ, but like you said, I think the Horsemen are just as successful, but I think I put him, I look at the Bobby Andre stuff and maybe say around the same with JJ with the formation of the Horsemen. I don't know if that goes as smoothly without him kind of being positioned as like the mastermind, but I think once they got formed, I think they could have easily existed as a quantity without him. I always look to him as like, I know he's just as good in theory as Bobby Heenan, but to me he was always like the level, the Bobby Heenan, like point, 1.0, and Bobby was Bobby Heenan 2.0.
I always love the story of Gary Hart carrying a blade, always got to keep it real, man. He's a guy who's like, if you cross them, he's going to slice your face up,
right?
Always protecting himself. I don't know. Plus he had one of the best autobiographies of, wrestling history. So have to throw that in there.
Yeah, and the more I watch World Class and whatnot, I mean, I'm fine with I'm fine with this one. I'm fine going with Hart over Dillon. I don't think it's that big of an upset or anything. I think they're pretty even. I think they had the same amount of scope, and I think it hurt Dillon too to leave when he did and go take the office job and kind of cut short the manager run. I know he had a long one, but I feel like if he had extended a few more years, then he could have really been used and either Dirty F or WCW. I mean, look at the hole that Heenan left when he went to the booth in 91. You know, maybe if JJ had been able to hang around for a couple of years, kind of taking over for him, maybe if he manages Flair with you know, Hennig or whatever, could have really added to his legacy. So, you know, I think it's good that he's, I think he's easily a top eight manager, but we're talking top four in the next round. So I'm fine moving hard over him.
All right. Who's our next challenge?
Be our 3-6, McGinn.
Our next contestants are Jim Cornette versus the man known as either by many names. His real name is William Alvin Moody, but we'll, for this sake, call him Percy Pringle.
Right. Okay.
So I think I would have had him 7 or 8 of this grouping here. So
who,
I think,
Cornette?
No. Pringle.
Oh.
No, Cornette's okay. a top two, top three, easy. So I'm fine, yeah. I'm fine with Cornette at 3.
Okay.
I think Pringle checks in a little high for me. That's all. Just a couple slots. I would have had him more in the 8 to 10 range versus like the 6th best. But he had a long career, world class. You know, Rick Rude and others when he was Percy Pringle, and then of course most synonymous with Undertaker, Kane, Mankind during that whole run. And he played a big role in that gimmick. And I know you hate the Kane stuff, and you're not the biggest Taker fan, but he was a major role in all their storylines. Obviously,
and how would you know I'm not the biggest Taker fan?
I didn't say. Well, you're not. I mean, you know, you're not.
Well, how would you know?
Because you talk about it all the time.
No, because I just told you before the show started.
No, but you've said it on many shows. I knew that one. Your Kane hate was the crux of your trip to hell.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I hate Kane. I think he sucks. I think Pringle as Paul Bearer sucked. I hated it. We're going to have to go back to world class in Florida. We're going to have to go old Southern scummy car salesman Percy Pringle for me to put him in a top eight setting.
Which he kind of transformed into in the later Paul Bearer run when he's with, like, when he got rid of the mortician look and just had like the red hair, and like he's really like a smarmy piece of shit in 98 before they go into like the, you know, Devil Undertaker stuff in 99. But did you ever see that, the Raw clip with him and Jerry Lawler talking about when he's talking about how he banged Taker's mom and they didn't have the cameras on? As a Lawler fan, I'm sure you've seen that clip, have you?
I think I have, but you, like I said, man, I mean,
great Paul, great, but that's like the sleaze bag. He became that. He brought a little bit of Percy Pringle into that run, is I guess my point.
Okay, yeah, and I like I said, I don't even care about that run. To me, I thought he was really great in late '89 as a babyface. He was kind of like a spokesman for USWA and the World Class versus USWA feud that had Eric Embry and P.Y. Chuhai. And then to me, Percy Pringle was a really great manager for Rick Rude.
Yes.
You know, in World Class, coming out the smooth operator. And I thought he gave Rick Rude some gravitas he wouldn't have had normally at that point in his career. So props to Pringle for that era, but I think we're wasting too much time on Paul Bearer when we should really be talking about the genius of Jim Cornette.
Yeah.
Little spoiler of, well, it's not a spoiler. A couple of weeks ago, I did a Exile on Bad Street with my buddy Zellner, and we talked about Cornette and how he was so great and forming these different tag teams. You know, because we think of Cornette with the Midnight Express, and that's where most of his run hinges on, is that Express run. And I don't even care about the Yokozuna stuff, because to me, he was a non-entity. You know, to me, Yokozuna is synonymous with
Fuji.
Yeah. But to me,
I do think he had a legitimacy.
Hold on.
Go ahead.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think, I think it was Jim Cornette grabbing a paycheck. That's it. Like it didn't fit. I didn't think it mattered. But to me, what really kind of makes Cornette stand out, besides the awesome Midnight Express run, is he was able to kind of replicate that in Smoky Mountain with the Heavenly Bodies. Mm-hmm. With, you know, he puts, first it was Stan Lane and Tom Pritchard, then it was Jimmy Del Rey and Tom Pritchard, and the Heavenly Bodies in the Rock and Roll kind of carried that company for 3 years. And so I think Cornette is easily top two, top three manager of all time, but I think people are sleeping on that Smoky Mountain run. And I think that people should listen to the Exile episodes with Zellner to kind of like get some of that Smoky Mountain love.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I'm with you 100%. I guess my Yoko thoughts are tied to my Fuji thoughts, who, especially with that time frame, wasn't like the devious Fuji anymore. He looked like a lost old man in many ways. And like, all right, Fuji got him to that point. He squishes Hogan. But bringing Cornette in added that extra, like, oomph that he needed to bring in that Heenan-ish guy that could do the quick talking, the legal contract. Like, a lot of that played into Yoko just being this quiet monster that stood there and ate rice and said, you know, bonsai, while Cornette did all the talking and all the spinning. And I don't know if Yoko could have had a long, like, you know, 9 or 10 month title reign, just him and Fuji not doing any, not having the kind of talking that Cornette did to carry a lot of those main event, you know, feuds, like the stuff with Luger and whatever you think of the Lice Express and that stuff. He was.
I don't think he needed it. You know, Yokozuna was so larger than life. You don't need much talking.
As a threat, right? Though, he's okay. I feel like, though, as a champion, where you're carrying the actual feud after feud, I feel like in the WWF at that time, you needed a guy who could talk. And I thought he'd be fine as like an upper card threat without being able to talk, like most of Fuji's guys would have been in the past. But I feel like when you get to the point where you are the champion and you're having feuds with guys like Luger or Undertaker, like, I feel like you needed someone to at least talk for you.
I think at that time, I think you're projecting, you know. At that time, I don't think it mattered at all. Honestly, at all. I don't think you needed Cornette to sell the feud. I don't need... You know, and I didn't believe that someone like Yokozuna would ever hire someone like Cornette. Like, we talked about Andre and Heenan, and could someone else, like, I didn't think it was a natural fit. And if you want the mouthpiece, that's fine. I didn't buy it. You know, even the Cornette with Owen and Bulldog in 96, I didn't buy that either. You know, it felt like Jim Cornette was a fish flopping around out of water.
What did you think of him with Vader?
Well, Vader's WWF run was so mishandled and maligned. I don't want to penalize Cornette for that.
But as a fit on the surface, like, I thought they worked.
I think Cornette and Vader in a better setting would have been awesome.
Right. So you think they fit? That's my question. They were fit together.
They're a good fit, okay, together, but in a better setting.
Yeah. And we had definitely talked on Cornette's lesser time. I mean, I don't think we need to spend too much anyway. Everyone knows the greatness of the Midnight Express and, of course, the memorable scaffold fall where he busted his knees apart and everything else. But I think his body of work, you know, carries him at least, obviously, here to the next round. He's easily one of the top four. So we already have Bobby Heenan. We have Jim Cornette. We have Gary Hart. And I'm guessing there's another Hart probably on the way, Dan McGinn. Give us our 2-7.
Not Stu Hart, for those following along. It's Paul Heyman taking on the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart.
So you had Heyman as your 7, huh?
I had Heyman as my 2nd.
Yeah.
Oh, you have Jimmy
Hart. Jimmy
Hart
is your number 7? Oh.
Yeah. My show. What do you want?
Ugh.
Wow.
You know what? Well, here's the thing. Y'all are WWF fans.
Hey, don't let me in with Dan McGinn. I had Jimmy Hart. He's in my top 3.
Okay, cool. Because to me, Jimmy Hart's WWF run, nothing special. WCW Hulk Hogan cheerleader, nothing special. To me, Jimmy Hart's entire argument hinges on that time from 1980, just talking nonstop trash about Jerry Lawler while Jerry Lawler's out with a broken leg, all the way up until he leaves Memphis in 85. Him and the Andy Kaufman dynamic.
See, that alone puts him there, him and Kaufman.
Oh, yeah, amazing. His awesome ability. Because, you know, we talked about Heenan earlier. Heenan had Andre to work with. Haku was a bad man. Jimmy Hart had some scrubs in the first family, you know. I mean, we're talking the bottom of the barrel, and if there was ever a man who could make chicken salad out of chicken shit, it was Jimmy Hart. And so many memorable angles, blaming Lawler for Andy Kaufman getting cancer, which was a low light of Memphis TV back then. Just to me. And this is why it's going to be hard when we get to that second round. And I'll quit the game if Jimmy Hart doesn't make it through. But having said that, Jimmy Hart hinged, like, that period from 80 to 84, Jimmy Hart Memphis, to me, is the greatest managerial run of all time. You know, but I don't know if I'd have him at number one, only because that was only part of his career. But to me, it destroys Heyman. Heyman was great as part of the Dangerous Alliance. I don't think he was really a manager. He was more of a mouthpiece for ECW. So I don't count any of the ECW run.
No.
And he was really good in Memphis.
Well, Brock, as, though. It, to me, the Brock stuff bumped him. So this is where I...
Brock stuff. So let me finish, though. Let me finish. Because we're forgetting when he was managing Austin Idol and Tommy Rich in Memphis in a very classic cage match that I think we might do a live watch for one of these days. Because, you know, I have no problem with watching more Memphis. And a very classic angle with Jerry Lawler getting his head shaved. Then you got to remember, he kind of carried the original Midnight Express and their feud with the Midnight Express in NWA, WCW, 1989-ish, 88-ish. So I give Paul Heyman props, but, you know, I don't want anyone to, like, put the ECW stuff. And the Brock stuff, that's just... you know, icing on the cake, but I don't care about the Brock stuff as much as like you would.
Well, I think Heyman, I mean, no, Heyman, I think McGinn careenoed Heyman here because I think he should have been, I think, probably in the top five or six and maybe would have had a shot to move on if he had been matched up in that 4-5 matchup because I think he does deserve at least consideration. I mean, he's not going to move over Jimmy Hart, but the Brock stuff is so big because I don't know if Brock Lesnar. I mean, he was great, but I don't know how his initial ascent goes in 02 without Heyman there to kind of shepherd him. And you talked about how J.J. Dillon was like a real, or Paul Ellering was like the real life business, you know, liaison for the Road Warriors and how that was such a big deal, how he was like the actual manager. To me, that plays a big part with Lesnar, too, because look at the association, a lifelong association with Brock Lesnar, even outside
I don't think Brock Lesnar ever let Heyman handle his money.
No, but I'm talking about as his associate mouthpiece. I mean, even in his UFC days, Heyman was still there cutting promos and doing promoting him and all that other stuff. So I'm talking about
UFC, but like not in UFC, but yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. Like Paul Heyman
was this cheerleader. He was right.
He went with him though. I mean, that to me they were like they're so associated with each other that Brock Lesnar leaves the WWF or WWE and Paul Heyman, who is his on-screen manager, is now like his real life hype man, you know? It was like Don King and Mike Tyson, you know? It was like this real life like promoter, which was kind of crazy. And then they come back together and his run now with Brock, the way he carries all these feuds when Brock's not even on TV is unbelievable. And you know, the only thing I ding him on is, you know, he hasn't worked out with anyone but Brock Lesnar in this time period. So they put him with Curtis Axel, and that fails.
Well, the Axel thing didn't bother me. Putting him with Ryback was a failure.
Cesaro.
Him and CM Punk, to me, was a failure.
Agreed.
You know.
And Cesaro, too.
And Cesaro was a definite failure. And, you know, but I blame, you know, I actually don't blame Heyman for that. To me, the Cesaro and the Punk thing was WWE completely misreading the crowd. Punk should have never been a heel when they turned him heel. And then when he finally became a face after Heyman turned on him, pairing him up with Ryback and Axel, like that's a kiss of death. And Cesaro, when they paired him up with Heyman, we've talked about it on the reaction show. Cesaro was hot shit after, you know, that battle royal.
Yep.
From WrestleMania 29, was it, or 30 or 31 or I don't
30
know.
30 was Cesaro, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. And, you know, to me, they screwed the pooch on that Cesaro face run at that point in time. So
all right, well, let's
I don't
move,
blame it.
Let's move
but we agree with Jimmy Hart?
Yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure we stumped for Heyman because I think Dan did him no service by putting him two against Jimmy Hart.
Yeah, no, I mean, all of these guys, I mean, we're talking about them. I mean, there's been, dozens of managers that we could have listed.
We can give our rank in a minute, but Heyman's in my top five. So, Dan, what do we have for so number one, we have Bobby Heenan taking on Gary Hart at five?
Yes.
Okay. I'm fine moving Heenan along. I don't think we even need to discuss. What do you think, Will?
I like Bobby Heenan a lot more than Gary Hart, and so I have no problem with that.
Okay. So now here's the tough one. We have Jimmy Hart and Jim Cornette in the upset seven, Jimmy Hart against the three Cornette, which is, you know, should be more of a 2-3, but a tough one here, Will. I'll let you go. You have, you know, closer
well, like,
ties
like
to
I
both
said, I love both these guys. If you look at it, like Jimmy Cornette, when he first started in Memphis, he was part of the first family. He was part of Hart's first family, you know, and he modeled a lot of his stuff after Jimmy Hart. Mm-hmm. You know, and to me, as great as Cornette was, I love Cornette, man. I love his Midnight Express run. I don't know if he had the longevity of peak that Jimmy Hart had. You know what I mean? Like the Midnight Express peak, because if you look, and it wasn't even Cornette's fault. It's like they really got hot like late 84, and then 86 was kind of like their really big peak. 87 and 88, they had great matches, and Cornette was still involved. But by that time, Dusty had kind of like screwed them over, you know, by not pushing them and kind of relegating them to mid-card status. You know what I mean? Like they weren't really, whereas from like 80 through 85, Jimmy Hart was the focal point of that heel run in Memphis. And I think circumstances prevented Cornette from like having that sustained run like Cornette. It's close, man. I mean, it just depends how much you value the other stuff. I would pick Jimmy Hart, but that's only because I think his peak is the highest peak for a manager ever.
Well,
so,
we're a little tight.
If you pick Cornette, I would not hate you and stop doing the show.
Okay, good. So we're a little tight on time, but my question to you is: does Jimmy Hart's, you know, Biggio like run towards the end? I mean, like, does his later year stuff take away from his peak at all? Because he hung around as a manager till 2000, and like his shit with Hogan was so like over the top, blah to me. Like I hated him as a face with Hogan.
It doesn't.
Stuff is like yeah, I like the Dungeon of Doom, but I mean, when you look at the guys he's with in WCW, and besides the Faces of Fear, a lot of that stuff is just like, ugh, you know, the Big Bubba Carson City match, the you know, the Leprechaun, like just all that shit that's out there. I mean, to me, that takes away a little bit.
It does absolutely takes away, but like I said, like I would argue that Cornette's WWF run takes away from Cornette. Like, I didn't think he was an effective manager in the WWF. You and I disagree on that. But having said that, I'm going to pick Jimmy Hart because I think the peak is an amazing peak. But I have no problem penalizing him for that other stuff at all.
No, I'm going to go Cornette. I think Cornette, just higher profile. Well, I don't know. The Andy Kaufman stuff was so good. We can make it a three-way battle. You want to make it to Cornette, Hart, and Bobby Heenan? Let's just discuss the three for the championship because...
Well, okay. Well, we discussed Cornette and Hart. For me, Bobby Heenan, like I said, I don't... Like, even when I was watching it live, the Andre stuff was compelling. I never cared about the King Kong Bundy or the Big John Studd stuff, even though it's kind of like memorable angles and stuff. Heenan was great on the mic. To me, Heenan's peak is the Bockwinkel stuff. The WWF stuff doesn't hold as much weight. But having said that, if you were to put a gun to my head for these three, I would put Bobby Heenan number one because I think overall, at least on film, we don't have the kind of dips
that Hart had.
Or with Cornette, we don't have... Like, Heenan never had that kind of mediocre, just kind of middle of the card, doesn't matter in the big scheme of things run.
And, two, if you look at even his little blip in 96 where he manages the Horsemen against the NFL, like, that was really good, too. But, yeah, Heenan's my one. I think we can agree that it's a tight, tight top three. I think my top five are Heenan, in no order. My top five guys are Heenan, Hart, Cornette, Heyman, and... Dylan, I think, would be my top
okay.
five guys.
Yeah, see, I would have Heenan number one overall career arc. The biggest peak for me is Hart, Jimmy Hart. That's why I would have him at my number two, okay? Even though, like I would say, number one, he had the best manager run, but, you know, didn't have the sustained career of Heenan. And then I'd put Cornette at three because he went from being the most entertaining person on TV for several years to being a footnote. And he talks about it in his great Midnight Express scrapbook, which everybody should get if they can get a copy of it. My number four would be Gary Hart. My number five would be Heyman, then Ellering, then Dylan, then Percy Pringle is eight only because he's number eight on this list that we came up with.
Right. Of course, Slick should have been in here, but we, you know, we left him out.
I liked Slick, man. Slick was fun.
All right, time.
It was awesome. No Frenchie Martin, thankfully, as well. So that was a lot of fun. You know, Game of Thrones is one of my favorite games here, and it's always, it, you always wonder how we're going to fill the time, and then all of a sudden we're up against it rushing through the finals. But I'm glad we got the whole thing through. I think it was smart making the triple threat, because I think Heenan, Cornette, and Hart are the top three either way. So I think they deserve to be in the finals.
I'd absolutely agree with that.
All right. Challenge one in the books. Why don't we go take a break, listen to what's going on in the old PTB podcast feed. By the way, a featured feed on Podbean, and all of our shows, the place to be, nation website podcast feeds, Sheedy Award winners. So I want to thank our friends over at Talking Sheet for recognizing us and all the people who voted for us. Thank you very much for the best podcast feed out there today. So thank you so much. And again, we're featured under Sports and Entertainment on Podbean as well. Lots of big-time sports podcasts on there. We're at the top of the sports and rec. So thank you so much for all your dedication, all your downloads, all your listens, all your voting, all your clicks. We appreciate all that.
I will have to say this, and I hate his wrestling opinions, but the idea that Johnny Sorrell didn't get best radio voice or best podcast voice is a fucking tragedy, and that's an absurdity. These people should be ashamed of themselves. That's all I want to say.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you, including Main Event, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Phil Schneider's Digging in the Crates, and our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse. And join Pro Wrestling Only's Will and I on the Dangerous Alliance podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to enjoy as well. We feature the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., The Kings of Sport, led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops, and the TJ McClune Show, featuring great guests from around the world of sports journalism. PTBN also proudly features the Richard the Mailman Podcast, specializing in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN also is the home to tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keith's RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net. All right, we're back from break. Hope you enjoy listening to that. Like I said, award-winning podcast feed, so thank you once again. And we're done arguing managers. Always a fun time, but what we're going to do right now is bring Dan McGinn back in to tell us what is challenge number two.
Guys, it's Card Wars. Nothing but Card Wars. The force has awakened up here in the McGinn family mansion, and I am once again back in my Wookiee costume. We are going one-on-one. It's the Great American Bash 96 versus King of the Ring 1996.
All right, so Card Wars is a fun one. I think we've only done it one time before, Will, and that was very early in the run of the show. We did Clash of the Champions 1 versus Saturday Night's Main Event 16, which aired...
might have been our first show, wasn't it?
Episode 2, we did Card Wars. And we haven't done it since, so it's back and very excited about it. And we picked this one because two pivotal shows for both companies. And it was a time where WCW was undergoing a lot of change in the summer of 96, where they really, you know, the first batch of change happened in summer 94 when Hulk Hogan arrived. And now the summer of 96 was very pivotal for them as they started to take a pull ahead in the Monday Night Wars. And for WWF, it was a pivotal time, pivotal, pivotal time.
Pivotal time
because it was the obviously launching of a megastar, and kind of the time you point to where they were really, you know, changing over the roster. Hall and Nash gone, Bret Hart on vacation, Shawn Michaels ascended to the top, and then we have this influx of guys from WCW that had been around for a little bit now, but this is to me where a lot of them really start to ascend. Vader, you know, Goldust is looked at as more of just than like a weirdo who stole the IC title. Now he's kind of a player. Brian Pillman makes his debut. So a lot of guys in that mold were starting to ascend up the card. Mark Mero had arrived, Steve Austin, obviously. So WWF going under a lot of changes and becoming a little bit more edgier starting at this show as well. So a big time for both companies. The shows happened a week apart, June 16th, 96 for Bash 96, and then June 23rd for King of the Ring. So why don't we start with the Bash, Will? Do you want to read the card down? Do you have it in front of you?
I do have it in front of me. Okay. So the Bash was a pretty important show. Not as important, though, as the Bash at the Beach, but it's okay. So it opens up with the Steiners versus Scott Norton and Ice Train. Okay. And then we got Conan versus El Gato. Then we have DDP versus Marcus Bagwell. Then Dean Malenko versus Rey Mysterio for a Cruiserweight title match. Our good friend John Tenta versus Big Bubba. Rest in peace to both of those guys. Chris Benoit versus Kevin Sullivan in a False Count Anywhere match where Dusty Rhodes had a famous comment about them wrestling in the women's bathroom.
There's a man in the women's bathroom. Is that one?
Yeah. Sting versus Steven Regal. Ric Flair and Arn Anderson versus Kevin Green and Mongo McMichael. And I believe that's when Mongo turned and became a horseman, right?
Yep. 20 minutes for that match. Almost 21 minutes.
Yeah, that's rough. And then the Giant versus Lex Luger was the main event for the WCW world title.
Actually, wasn't it there's a woman in the men's room? I think that's what it is. There's a woman in the men's room, baby.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
So I just watched a show not too long ago. Giant Luger, very, very forgettable, as you'd expect. Giant as world champion in 96 is kind of weird. Doesn't have that many great matches. Great presence, but just a little over his head and kind of stuck out weird during this time. The Horseman match isn't, for the length, it's actually not as bad as you'd think. Like I said, it had the Heenan stuff with Savage and Heenan on the outside. You got Deborah and all that stuff going on, and Kevin Green's wife as well. You have women and Liz, the devilish women on the other side. And the big turn. I like the big turn there, and solidifying Mongo as the Horseman. It made sense with the Halliburton, the money. And the match really isn't as bad. And Sting Regal is really, really good too, right? Isn't that one of your favorites?
It's one of my favorite Sting matches.
Right, yep.
Because to me, Regal and Vader are the only like really great Sting matches out there. I don't think Flair and Sting ever had like a great match together. Sting and DDP had really good matches. I know
Triple
they had
H.
like the really hot Triple H what?
Sting and Triple H.
Oh, that sucked. That was horrible. It was embarrassment to wrestling. Bunch of old guys reliving their past. That sucked. Anyway, so yeah, so that was hot. You know what? I remember not liking John Tenta versus Big Bubba, watching it, you know, 10 years ago or whatever it was. But that's kind of a match where I've kind of like revisited both guys, and I like both of them, so I kind of want to rewatch that with fresh eyes.
The Carson City match is a little bit more fun. That's the next month.
Okay. And then Malenko versus Mysterio was great.
Oh, yeah.
And the opener, man, the Steiners versus Norton and Ice Train was awesome. Just not a great match, but just kind of like a great opener to kind of like amp up the crowd and just kind of like throw a bunch of power moves.
Oh, just
you know,
the shit out of each other. I was so into Fire. Fire and Ice is one of my favorite teams of that time. And even watching those Nitros again recently and the build up to their split was very sad because it seemed so early for them to split up. Like they were really just getting into a groove. And there was a gnarly Frankensteiner to Norton in that match.
Yep, yep. So
one of the worst.
So, and the rest was forgettable. But I say Benoit versus Sullivan's forgettable because I like to try and forget about Chris Benoit as much as I can.
But it does add to the card a little bit in historical feature because it's a very, very memorable match in many ways. I mean, that was their big one.
Pre-2007, yes. I would have been singing the praises of the match.
We didn't have to sing the praises, but it's memorable part of the card.
But post-2007, I just assume forget it ever happened. Okay. Having said that, we didn't even mention probably the most famous thing on this show. Eric Bischoff interviewing Hall and Nash. Who's the third member of the NWO? When are you going to wrestle the guys from WCW? Nash kicks him in the gut, power bombs him off the stage. Eric Bischoff, the head of WCW, getting power bombed through the stage. That was like the really memorable epic moment. Yeah,
very epic. And funny story. So for this show, happened on Father's Day, and I remember we had a cookout at my house, and I came inside and I wanted to order the show, and I was really close to ordering it, but I held off. And it ended up being prescient, because normally for the Dodie F shows, I went to my buddy's house and I was all ready to go because he had the illegal box. So I'm like, okay, I'll order the bash and then go watch King of the Ring for free at his house. Well, he failed like a summer school class or something stupid, and his mom wouldn't let me come over. So I ended up having to order King of the Ring myself, which I probably wouldn't have been able to swing if I had gotten the bash. So I ended up watching the bash scrambled, even though I wanted to order and came very close, mainly because I wanted to see that Fire and Ice Steiner Brothers match. I watched the whole show on Scramble Vision, and I remember just going nuts with the, not being able to really see, but just hearing Bischoff go through the table was like out of control.
I watched it. I watched it all after, dude. It was the NWO that got me back into wrestling, and we that's why we're kind of doing sold out in our third challenge. So I didn't watch this stuff till I already had the internet. And then once I got back into wrestling and found out about all these shows I should be watching, I'd go to my local Blockbuster. So if you're too young to remember Blockbuster, folks, one, you're probably not listening to the show, but two, it's where you actually used to have to go rent videos.
Go to PlayStation.com and search Blockbuster, and you can read all about me and Jen Engel did a piece on the death of the video store, the life and death of the video store. So we missed the 90s video.
That's
store.
Awesome, man. Dude, send me the link to that. If you can, message it to me at Pro Wrestling Only, if you will. I'd love to,
well, there it is right there.
To read that. But yeah, so I would go and I would like rent things like Great American Bash or Bash of the Beach 96, or some of the WWF ones they'd have were like Buried Alive from 96, or I'm trying to think what other like shows I remember renting. SummerSlam 92 was one of the shows I picked up from the video store.
Yep.
So I wasn't around when it happened, but it was this whole NWO momentum that actually got me into watching wrestling. Then once I started watching wrestling again, then I started, watching both Raw and Nitro on Mondays and doing kind of the Monday Night War thing,
I do know. El Gato, was that Pat Tanaka?
I don't know.
Yes, it was. Yep.
He was, did you look it up? Was that who it was?
Yeah, he was under the hood against Conan. Conan's a weird there, too. It's right before he started doing more of the gangsta stuff that came right after this.
I love gangsta Conan.
Well, it started like right – it was like a few weeks after, because I just saw the Nitro. I think it's like August when he's sitting in the crowd with like the gang wear on, and they're like, oh, that's Conan. What's he doing? And I think he joins the Dungeon of Doom like right after that.
I like really bad cheesy early 90s Milli Vanilli-ish Bell Biv DeVoe Conan, when he had like the braided hair. And I like Gangsta Conan.
Yeah, Gangsta Conan with the peeling the potatoes and the tossing the salad.
Oh, that was all later, but yeah. this is like Conan like trying to be really body-o, whereas later on he would just like, take Master P lyrics and throw them out there.
Bowdy bowdy. All right, why don't we do King of the Ring 96? Talk about that for a bit, and then we'll spend the last 10 minutes or so.
All right.
Dissecting.
So I'm not going to run down the dark matches here.
No, that's fine.
And we had Austin versus Mark Marrow, and that was a King of the Ring semifinal, right?
Yes. Yep. Only the final three matches were on this.
Yeah. Then we had Jake Roberts versus Vader. Another King of the Ring match. And then we had the Smoking Guns versus the Godwins. Probably Jerry Lawler's worst match in WWF, the Ultimate Warrior match. I don't know. It's probably between this one and Jake. Mankind versus The Undertaker. Ahmed Johnson versus Goldust for the IC title. Austin defeating Jake Roberts for the King of the Ring. And Shawn Michaels versus Davey Boy Smith. Is this the one where he throws a bitch fit in the middle of the ring, or is
no,
that a 95?
Yeah,
20 minutes, guys. 20 minutes.
Okay.
It was a month before this.
Okay. So anyway, so yeah, that was your card, man. So that was 96. And this is another card where I didn't watch it live. I didn't know about any of this stuff until much later. And I watched it later, and I was kind of underwhelmed by the whole thing. But there are some good matches on this card.
And I watched it live and was freaking out. So there's two things that aren't in the list here, you know, equivalent to the outsiders throwing Bischoff through the table. We have, obviously, the coronation of Steve Austin with the Austin 316 and his big breakout moment. I mean, iconic. And then
hold on, though. I'm not trying to interrupt you, but yeah. I want to say it's iconic in retrospect.
No,
it really is. At the time, it was not. Yeah. No, because he didn't move numbers. It didn't do anything. You know what I mean? In the sense, it's iconic because he became the biggest wrestling star of all time.
Yeah, but they
and
didn't.
It's part of his story.
And I think, but part of it is that they didn't immediately take advantage of it. If he came out the next night and was presented as a top level star, it would have cracked. Because if you watch, there's already signs the next night for Austin 316, and I remember like immediately, and I'm right in the wheelhouse of the fan that was making WWF tick in '96. You know, Die Hard. And I remember like downloading the audio clip as soon as I could on AOL, making it my sound when I had mail. Like, I mean,
hold on. How long did it take you to download that?
Quick.
About 17 hours?
Yes. Well, that was just a quick audio. So probably just about like 40 minutes or so, but it was, it was
for a 3 second clip.
It was a whole other world. The worst was getting screwed by theme traders. I always tried to collect the wrestling theme songs and they'd like, you'd send them one and they'd send you a fake one. It was awful. Awful world. But I think it was immediate because he immediately was a name guy versus just another upper mid card guy. Now he had a hook and they didn't take advantage of it right away. But I knew at the time, like, oh my God, this guy is like awesome from this promo. And even the moment, and to be fair, I was a big Hollywood Blondes fan, but the moment where Pillman comes out and they stop and stare at each other and they cross, you know, Pillman crosses the throat and like, it just felt like Austin's night. Like even beyond, you know, the 316, the whole thing felt like, wow, they're really getting behind this guy. And it was palpable on that night. You could see it. The way they handle the booking of the show where he leaves the arena, goes and gets the stitches in his mouth, comes back, beats the shit out of Jake Roberts. The ref has to stop the match. Showdown with Pillman, cuts the promo. It's like, wow, this guy has arrived. It really felt like that. So maybe it didn't feel like he's going to be the all-time box office, you know, smash biggest wrestler of all time. But it felt like, wow, this guy went from, okay, another WCW guy that they got like Vader and Gold, like all these guys are kind of in the mix, and it immediately to me pushed him up a notch.
And yeah, to me he didn't really, like, for me revisiting it, and you know, even at the time, Austin to me kind of felt like a big deal around Survivor Series with him in the Bret match.
Yeah, but I don't think he ever gets to that point without this.
No, of course not. But what I'm saying though is that if you look at like the fans tuning in, nobody gave a shit.
I see. You know I disagree. What I mean?
But you were already a fan. Austin at that time did not draw people in to WWF
because they weren't aware.
Because nobody cared.
Well, they didn't tune in for him in '97 until Mike Tyson made them care.
That was '98, but yeah, NWO drew people like me who didn't give a shit about wrestling for 7 years back into the fold.
Well, that's because Hulk Hogan turned heel. I mean, you knew of Hulk Hogan, right? I mean, the biggest star in wrestling history turned heel.
Well, that's not why I got back in, because I didn't give a shit about Hogan. I just actually, you know, what got me was kind of the insider shooty, dark, anything can happen vibe. You know what I mean? Because my buddy's like, dude, and we're gonna get to this with '97 with the sold out show. He's like, watch this show, man. This is like nothing I've ever seen.
Yeah, so when was it that you when in the NWO run?
Late 96, kind of like that Piper Hogan build. And
right. So Hogan was already there. So Mike...
and then the lead up to the 97, the sold out show.
Yeah, but so you found out about it where Hogan was already, like, would you have heard about it if it was Hall and Nash and not Hogan having turned heel? I know Hogan wasn't the reason you got into it, but the NWO doesn't pop or get as big without Hogan.
The only reason I heard about any of it is because one of my buddies I worked with was actually, a big wrestling fan. You know what I mean? I would have heard of none of it.
Okay, so it didn't pop, though. That your argument was that the NWO brought you in as a fan, but that's because you had to be told. Just like people had to be told to watch Steve Austin.
Okay. But nobody told me, hey, go watch WWF because Austin cut this promo. Right? Well, they didn't tell me, hey, you know, because probably because nobody watched King of the Ring 96.
Well, I think that's so part of it. That's kind of
that's
my point.
What I'm saying, though, which goes back to my point where it's part of the legend of Steve Austin, but at the time it did not move a needle. It did not make an immediate impact on the WWF product because, dude, a few months later, it was a horrible, like, gimmick. The pay-per-view was actually pretty fun, but then you have, like, stupid shit like the Buried Alive stuff. You know, it was still cartoon WWF land.
Yeah, but guys,
whereas
like Steve Austin had started
had
to turn the tide.
Change, had completely changed.
No, it hadn't. If you watch the stuff around the – and I know it legend makes you think it has. I just watched all those Nitros
dude,
and Hamburgers.
I compiled 10-year books
for
a decade where I watched all of that
stuff.
Yeah,
but Austin turned it around years later too. If you watch the months around the Outsiders' initial ascent, right, before they became the big bad NWO, just like you're comparing to Austin's initial growth and ascent – there was still other cartoony shit in WCW at the same time. Glacier. There were 17 Glacier promos on every Nitro, and I'm in September. And they're still showing Glacier.
97, right? Wasn't it?
No, 96. Glacier promos all through 96. And, like, they're still doing that goofy shit, and you still have the Carson City match with Big Baba and John Tenta, and you have the Dungeon of Doom running around. Like, that shit all still existed cartoony in the world of the NWO, and the NWO
Dungeon
helped them.
Hold on. The Kevin Sullivan Doom with the stupid...
No, the later one with Jimmy Hart with the leprechaun. He's running around and Faces of Fear, Big Bubba with the biker gimmick. Like, all that Dungeon Doom still existed. They've been feuding. They're still having issues with the freaking Horsemen at this point.
But it wasn't at the top of the card.
No.
Right? The top of the card was Savage and Flair. I mean, you know what I mean? There's a big difference between having, like, cartoony shit in the mid card to kill time and cartoony shit heading your
My point is both led to the evolution of the product from within. So the Austin 316 moment was iconic because that moment made it feel like that, combined with Brian Pillman coming out and telling Jim Ross, you know, calling him a stupid son of a bitch and that he's gonna rape pillage.
Yeah, doing the gun stuff later on. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
but even that night when those two, as a fan of that time period, that can tell you, like, this shit was wicked milquetoast, and then all of a sudden, in one night, and the WWF having to answer, you have Austin 316, I just whipped your ass, and quoting, you know, Bible quotes, and running down Jake Roberts for being a drunk, and, you know, get your cheap bottle of Thunderbird, like, all that, like, that combined with Brian Pillman coming out and saying, I'm going to rape, pillage, and plunder the WWF, and call Jim Ross, you stupid son of a bitch, and then crossing his throat, all of a sudden felt like, okay, WWF is starting to arrive now with this more, you know, grown-up stuff too. And it took time, but those guys working their way up through the undercard helped to bring that change. And the Austin 316 moment to me was iconic because it launched that change. Like, all of a sudden, okay, these guys are here too. They can swear. They can be real. They can be realistic. They can run down the things we're thinking. Jake Roberts.
You know what I would say? I would say that because you're starting to filibuster there for a while.
Filibuster, baby. Break me down.
Yeah, I would say that even if you look at earlier, like late 95, Kevin Nash, remember when he was like, I got my friend, my real fans with me and I don't care. And he was kind of trying to do that rebellious anti-hero deal. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
There's a Kevin Nash promo. Yeah. Whereas I think that WWF would show hints of that. You know what I mean? I mean, they weren't completely Hulk Hogan cartoon era, but, you know, there was a big difference, like, say, in 97, you know, like when Bret Hart's, you know, hijacking the ring and he's pissed off and tearing shit up because he lost to Sid in the cage match and cuts shoot promos. Like, we're not there yet. I'm not saying it's not an important moment. What I'm saying, though, is that this NWO thing really felt like a completely new wind change in the company, whereas Austin felt like it wasn't there yet. It wasn't until 97 where Austin really takes over.
But it's
that's
the same
what
thing.
I'm saying.
Sure, he
no,
takes
no,
over,
it's
but the
not.
Needle,
it,
yeah, but the needle
this,
still doesn't
this,
move.
This, but this
that's your
right
comparison
here.
Point.
But this right here. But what I'm saying, even interest level, right here, this was a promo, granted, but it's not like that they pushed Austin to the moon afterwards, right? Whereas the NWO was the focal point. They were the main event right out of the gate. Whereas this is great promo. It's a great promo. It's an iconic moment for a guy who would go on to be the biggest thing, but at the time didn't mean anything.
I don't.
And I'll stand by that. But let's talk. Okay,
10 minutes to go. 10 minutes.
Yeah, let's talk about the matches here.
Yeah.
So speaking of Austin, the Mark Merrill match, really good. But I always, like, you know, after watching that 94 stuff with you and Scott and Charles, love Mark Merrill anyway. I think, you know, he's a guy who gets a bad rap by the wrestlers. But, and they probably know more about him as a person than I do, so I'm not going to argue.
It's a much better match than the one at International Incident. The two always get compared. The one the next month felt flat. This one was really good. King of the Ring was better.
Bulldog and my man, HBK, who's not really my man, but I always felt like they should have had a classic, but they never had a classic. They always had good matches, but I never felt like they had that. Like, they never had that, like, Brett Bulldog that from 92. Right. Or, like, even Bulldog Regal from Halloween Havoc 93, which I think is better than any Bulldog HBK match I've seen.
The one night only in London was great just because of the heat. This to me, I think, was technically.
Oh yeah, that was the best. That was the best one in terms of atmosphere.
Right,
you're absolutely right about that.
I think this is their best in ring effort. Had Mr. Perfect at ringside, 26 minutes. It more than makes up for the mess at Beware a Dog the month before. I thought this was a really, really good match. I think it's much better than Great American Bash's top matches, which were Luger Giant and the Horseman. And the NFL guys. I think this is where the one spot where this card stands out over that card is the main event is much, much, much better. Also, Owen Hart was really funny on commentary throughout the show. He was in the booth. He was really good. Mankind Taker can drag, but it's another one along the lines to me like Austin and the Pillman thing where it kind of signaled the change where Mankind beat him. And it was a brawl in the type that they hadn't really. I mean, they did the Michaels Diesel one, but it felt different. It felt very garbagey, which they hadn't done a ton of. And to see Mankind beat Undertaker was another like mega seminal moment on the show.
Was this the first Mankind win over Taker?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Because everyone else figured at the time, okay, it's just another Challenger of the Month. Taker beats him. Like Taker had never lost like that before. You know, you had the Mabel one the year before, but that was, you know, straight chicanery. This was like Mankind went toe to toe with him. And knocked him off in his own, you know, kind of garbagey match. So a big moment there. The rest of the card, you know, kind of blah. You had Ahmed Goldust is fine. Big moment for Ahmed. But to me, what carries this are the moments. Austin 316, Taker losing, Pillman debut, and then the main event being really good. And it's just, it's a breakthrough show for them. And it was like their first edgy show. During the time, I know they did the Diesel stuff and that was edgy, but to me, this was the first like top to bottom show where if you watch it, it just feels like kind of gritty. And that was what beget the Attitude Era for them. The gritty feel of the show.
For me, that started later on, but you know, I mean, we already spent most of this 20 minutes fighting on that one.
It's great about the show, right?
Yeah, sure. And, I will say that, for this show, it is a good show. You know, I think the Warrior thing, I think we didn't even talk about that. Why, right? Trying to bring Warrior back is a huge mistake here.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he should never have been brought back. Should never pin the legend like Jerry Lawler. That's for sure. Their tag division was garbage. The Guns were garbage. Awful. The Godwins were garbage.
Sonny,
I guess
was
this
the best part.
Was this like Yoko Owen era?
No,
as well?
That was the year before.
Okay, yeah, still garbage. The Mankind Taker thing, I guess I have no love for either guy right now. I actually have more love for Undertaker than I do Mankind. Like, I don't care if I ever watch another Foley match. That's just where I'm at right now. But we didn't mention Ahmed Johnson beating Goldust might have been the biggest pop of the night.
Oh, yeah. And his dive over the top. This is Ahmed's peak. He had been gaining a lot of steam into this show. And then his win here was, like, massive. And he has a really good month where he's, like, positioned alongside Shawn Michaels as, like, the top dog in the company. And then he gets hurt and he's never the same. But when you look at him on this show, you're thinking, like, and Vince McMahon, I'd be thinking the same thing. Like, oh, shit, I have my next, like, mega star here. This guy right here. That's what he looked like at this show.
Right. Yeah, no, I thought he was. Like, Ahmed Johnson, like, when at that time, you know, we've been talking about that time where I wasn't watching wrestling. Around that time, Ahmed was the guy that I thought, this guy's a million bucks. You know, I'd never seen him wrestle, just looking at him, seeing him on like Raw, you know.
Five minutes to go, guys.
This guy is going to be the guy who kind of leads the charge for this company, not knowing that the guy was clumsy as fuck or a horrible wrestler.
And never knew that until, you know, Farooq kicked him in the kidney and then it all went downhill.
Right. Like, so I didn't know any of that stuff. I just going on presence and kind of like that innate charisma, even though he was a kind of a horrible marble mouth talker, you know, you know, he was still a really kind of like phenomenal piece of talent to like, you know, build like I always look at like if he was a creator wrestler in a video game, you would create Ahmed Johnson.
Well, his charisma is like a poor man Sid, the charisma, like this wild, made no sense, like crazy, the look that's dripping with sweat and just connected with the crowd, like immediately just had this presence about him.
Oh, almost Goldberg-like, except without the money-drawing power.
And maybe if he could have stayed healthy, he could have gotten there, because I think, you know, he wasn't bad in the ring. I mean, and he would fly around, and, you know, he's doing the stuff like Ryback tries to do now, you know, like the big man doing, you know, topes over the top, all this crazy shit, and the pervert plunge looked great. It was, I mean, he had the package, just couldn't stay healthy, and then he got clumsy and sloppy and kept getting hurt. But for a snapshot in June to July of 96, he looked like the next big thing.
All right, so let's compare a couple of things here. So if we look at tag matches, if we look at Steiners versus and Norton Ice Train versus Godwin's and Smoking Guns, Steiners versus Norton Ice Train, that gets it, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. If we look at garbage matches, we're going to look at the DDP match, the Conan match, and then even the main event, Giant Luger, is nothing. If you go main events, HBK Davey Boy is going to take it every day of the week.
Runs laps, yep.
I'm going to say I would pick the NWO moment as more important, but I wouldn't, not in the overall scheme, but I'm saying for the here and now, for the time being, in the overall scheme, Austin moment much more important, you know. But for the time period, I'm gonna argue that the NWO thing was bigger, but it's not even the most important NWO moment within a month.
Say, right.
But it doesn't matter because it's still huge
at the time.
You know, still huge at the time. Sting Regal, I think, is really awesome. I don't care about Mankind Taker. I don't know if there's anything – like if you were to compare Sting Regal to Austin Merrill, I don't think anything is as good as Sting Regal or Malenko Mysterio on that King of the Ring card.
Malenko Mysterio is what sets Bash apart to me. I think it's easily the best match on either night, and I think Sting Regal is probably second. I do like Austin Merrill a lot. Like I don't think it's far behind Sting.
Oh, good
Regal.
Match. Good match, yeah.
But see, and Michael's Bulldog. To me, those are the top four matches on the two cards.
I like William Regal so much, Steven Regal, that even when the match isn't great, I love his performance.
Yep.
If we were doing 97 and like going and watching his Ultimo Dragon or Prince Ikea matches, I would say, look at how amazing Regal is here. Look at how amazing Regal is there, you know?
I think Bash has a little bit more fill, only in the way that the fill on King of the Ring at least plays into the tournament. Like, sure. Vader Jake is Phil, but Jake getting murdered by Vader after the match, and it's only a 3-minute match, plays into the finals. And Austin Jake is a nothing match, but it's all about the moment within that match. So to me, the throwaway shit on King of the Ring isn't as time wasting as it at the Bash. Like Tenta Bubba is kind of blah, Conan Elgato, DDP Bagwell, like all that stuff is really blah.
And that's one of the biggest knocks against WCW, period, is having such a huge and deep roster is just putting stuff on pay-per-views to fill time, which when we do our rebooking
– 1 minute to go.
We're really going to get to that because they could have had knockout 5-star pay-per-views every single month, and a lot of times they just missed the mark because they didn't book their talent correctly.
So I think Bash has the higher peaks, but I think overall from a, like, just how tight King of the Ring, I think King of the Ring's just, I don't know, they're close. This is really close.
I would pick Bash 96. I think it's a show that, like I said, I have no connection to Mankind Taker at all. I don't care if I ever watch HBK versus Davey Boy again. Like, I really don't. I don't care if I ever see that match again. The Austin stuff I can watch on comps. So if I were to have to watch a show, if you told me, hey, we're going to watch a show, we're going to do like a simulcast where we watch the whole show, I would veto King of the Ring and I would say, let's watch Great American Bash all day, all
Giant
week.
Luger does ding it for me a bit, because after the Outsiders moment and the Horseman turn, that match feels so, like, lingering there.
Yeah, and not the last time that would happen.
Yeah.
Not the last time.
They should have closed with the Horseman thing, I think.
So think about that sold-out 98 show where they tacked on Luger Savage after the Great Heart Flair match.
Right.
They always did that crap, or where they'd have like Sting versus Scott Hall go do a 6-minute main event or something. You know, I mean, WCW was horrible about that. You mm-hmm. know, but that's what they always said. You know, you'd have the super strong, undercard yeah. with a super weak main event.
Yeah, and
time is up.
Both really good shows.
All right, time's up. We don't hear you anymore.
This is the closest we're going to get, I think, as far as cards in the same month. Because
watch Great American Bash and pretend you've already seen King of the Ring.
if you look at other shows like WWF and WCW, and this is a game maybe I want to play sometime too. We've talked about it with Scott. Like, what month had the best overall wrestling content on pay-per-view? This is up there, I think. I don't think we're going to get too many other times where, like, both shows in a month were really, really high level. Dan Quick, would you choose here?
I'd probably go Bash on this
it's
one.
It's a toss-up. It's a close one. All right, let's take a break. Hear all the PWO, BWN feed shows. Again, Shibi award-winning. We'll be back with challenge number 3 and mail.
Watch pro wrestling. Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only place to be nation podcast network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, Placement Nation, we're back. Hope you're enjoying the 16th episode here of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. And, Will, it's been a pretty fun, you know, 6 months or so here in the DAWP world. So we've had a lot of fun games, a lot of fun challenges.
Is this the six-month six-month anniversary?
I don't know. When did we start this thing? I can look quick. I know we started in the summer. I want to say it was June or July we started. So I think we're right around 6 months. Let's see here.
All right.
I'm going to find out. We started on May 29th, 2015, so a little over 6 months now.
Oh, yeah, it's been more.
A lot of fun. Anyway, with that said, Dan, why don't you come in and tell us the challenge number 3?
Thanks, guys. We're going to be rewriting history. Excuse me. We're going to be rewriting history, guys. It's going to be January 1997. WCW. I would sit here and filibuster this entire game for you, but I'm going to stick to my script and just tell you to let the games begin.
Okay. And I think we've had enough people imitating Chad on these shows to last a lifetime. So
y'all are killing me with those Chad imitations.
Oh boy! So this this tied in well with the, and we really didn't plan this; it just kind of happened. But it ties in well to the discussion we just had. We talked a lot about the summer of '96 in WCW. And we've done this game again, I think, is another one we've only done maybe once, rewriting history. We've done a lot of kind of, you know, rebooking individual moments or what ifs, but I think this is only the second time where we've gone through and rewritten the history of a month. And we did it before, back in episode 3, we rewrote December 96 in the WWF. So right around the same time, a month later now, we move over to WCW. And it's an important month because it was the first ever sold out, which is the NWO only pay-per-view. Happened on a Saturday night, January 25th, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And I remember being really cool because, a Saturday night pay-per-view was awesome. I remember it started a little bit later, 8 o'clock, and I believe it was Super Bowl weekend. So it was a really cool weekend. I have the pay-per-view Saturday, Super Bowl Sunday, which I think would have been, it was a Patriots-Packers, I think. And I'll look at that, Will. Why don't you read us down the card, and then we'll go from there.
Which card am I reading now?
Sold out 97, babe.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, that Packers Super Bowl was awesome.
It was the next day. It was, yeah. So the next Packers 35, Pats 21, January 26th, 97.
So the show takes place in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I want to make that clear because it kind of plays into the show. And it's Masa Chono versus Chris Jericho. Masa Chono, part of the NWO. Big Bubba versus Hugh Morris. I'm guessing Big Bubba was
yes,
NWO at the time. Yeah. Did they call him Big Bubba?
Yeah, Big Bubba Rogers, yeah.
Okay. Jeff Jarrett versus Mr. Wall Street, which was Mike Rotundo. Did he have the WCW crossed out?
No, I think he's still NWO here. I think it was right after where is it J.J. Dillon, I think, by that point, comes out and says anyone who hadn't joined the NWO before the cutoff date, they have, like, a special date, is banned, like, not allowed. And I think Bubba and Wall Street are the two guys that get booted from there. And Wall Street is the crossed-out NWO.
And then Bagwell, Buff Bagwell versus Scotty Riggs and the former American Males. Then we have Scott Norton versus DDP, and Norton's already NWO at this time.
Yeah. Yep.
The Steiners versus the Outsiders, and this match is probably more famous because of the night after than it is for the match itself. Eddie Guerrero versus Six in a ladder match, and did both guys get hurt in this one, or was it just Six?
Yeah, I don't think it was both. I don't believe
okay.
so.
I believe this led to, like, lingering injuries, though, that kind of hampered both guys. And then the world title match, Hulk Hogan versus the Giant, was the main event. And so this pay-per-view actually got me back into wrestling because my buddy had told me, like, hey, man, you need to check out this wrestling. And I was like, wrestling, I was a kid. It's all cartoon bullshit. And then I watched it. I was like, man, this is like nothing I'd ever seen. Mm-hmm. You know, they were being smartasses on the mic as announcers. I'm not saying that's a good thing for business. I'm saying it was a good thing to get me drawn in, you know.
Yep.
And it really was unlike anything I'd ever seen. And just my buddy had given me kind of like a quick background story on the NWO and what had happened. And after I watched this tape, I was like, man, I got to find out what happens next. Like, they completely hooked me around this time, even though I had seen some of the stuff with Piper before because of my buddy that I worked with. And I think this card... Once again, with WCW curse, too many great talent, not using them properly. This could have been a really good card if they would have positioned it differently.
Mm-hmm. And it opens with the great, remember they're riding down the street on the garbage trucks through the city of Cedar Rapids. I always love that open where they come marching into the arena. And what did you think of the black and white presentation?
Loved it at the time. Now I can see why people would be put off by it, but I loved it. I loved the whole NWO commercials, all of it, you know, when they were going on.
And of course, we also had the beauty pageant throughout the show, if you remember as well. With
all that. We're going to talk about that. And I think that it was a way for them to show that they're assholes.
Right.
But I think in building the NWO brand was a huge mistake. I think that they should have shown that NWO pulls hot tail better than WCW.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
I really do. I think that it was a huge mistake for them not to, like, legitimately have hot women in their contest. I get what they're doing and, you know, kind of weight shaming all these poor women and everything. But I really think it was a huge mistake. I think that they should have gone with, like, really hot chicks.
And, of course, DiBiase and Bischoff did commentary, too, which was ended up being kind of bland because it was so – the whole thing is so pro-NWO, which is the point. But yep. it wears a little thin after a while.
Yeah. But it does, but not if – it wears thin now because we know the whole story.
Right, but at the time,
I was – like I said, it's kind of like – it's like, you know, and I'm not going to spoil Star Wars, the new movie, for anybody who hasn't seen it, you know, for the billion people who've already seen it. You know what I'm talking about. The first time I saw the new Star Wars, I couldn't really critique it
right
objectively because it was kind of like sensory overload.
Yeah.
Holy shit. This is new Star Wars. That feels like Star Wars. Well, to me, this was wrestling that felt like no wrestling I'd ever seen before.
Right. Yeah.
100%. So the flaws like that, like the horrible woman contest, the bad booking on parts of the show didn't mean anything because the sensory overload and the balls that it took to do this show were completely unlike anything I'd ever seen.
So one of the big issues, and I don't know if we can rebook it, is January, because I think it already started before January. So I mentioned before, obviously, I'm rewatching these Nitros and the pay-per-views, and I'm all through up to Fall Brawl 96. And in September of 96... we're just getting like a little bit of expansion of the NWO. Teddy DiBiase had debuted, Giant turned, and then they do the fake Sting, and that's leading up to Fall Brawl. Now we jump ahead here. What, 3 months later? Masa Chono, Big Bubba, Michael Wallstreet, Buff Bagwell, Scott Norton, you know, Six, Hogan, DiBiase, Nick Patrick, Eric Bischoff. You know, it's like it expanded so rapidly that it started to get a little watered down already. And the fact that the Giant had already turned and then turned back was like, what the hell? And he feels, you know, I just watched the turn yeah. like the other night and it felt so forced. Like, why is he turning? It makes no sense. And like, it doesn't fit. And then he turned right back. You know, it's like, it already like hurt the aura of the NWO. To me, the NWO should have stayed longer as being pure guys outside WCW. Like, Giant had no reason to be part of that group the way it was constructed.
Or Scott Norton.
Well, yeah, but Scott Norton, you can at least say, is like a Japanese guy, and he's like kind of an outsider. Remember, he debuted on Nitro by calling out Randy Savage.
But like Wall Street, Bubba.
Right. Well, yeah, they're
scrubs. Those are WWF guys. Even, you know who I would have put in, and he's on the show? Jeff Jarrett.
Right, yes.
Guys I would have like put that. Jeff Jarrett.
And that was the tease. That was the tease too for a while with them. But it shouldn't have been guys that were jumping ship already from WCW, like Bagwell. And you know, it turns Bagwell around. Like it's big for him. It just didn't have to happen so soon. It's like we're months in and you already have the Giant jumping. And it makes no sense. He's a homegrown WCW guy. Like he should have just stayed Team WCW. It made right. zero sense. You know, eventually you turn Savage. Okay, that makes sense. He's another WWF guy. Like, those are the type of guys I should have been joining. And you look at it here, it goes so watered down so quickly. And sure, it allows them to have a pay-per-view. But on the flip side, it's like this group was so elite just 4 months ago. And now right. you have guys like freaking VK Wall Street on, you know, in the group. It just made it feel so blah already.
Well, let's do this, JR. Who would you have in the NWO? Because we got to fill out a card.
Right.
And let's just say, like, is Muda already in? Because if Chono's in, Muda's in, right? Like him
yeah,
and?
Yeah, I think they joined together, yeah.
Okay. So let's say Muda's part of the group, right?
Yeah.
I don't. So if we're going to let Norton come in, we're going to let Muda and Chono be a part, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's kind of rebook this card, right? First of all, I wouldn't have had the Steiners versus the Outsiders, even though I had the memorable angle. And for people who don't know what I'm talking about, the Outsiders lose the titles here to the Steiners. And was it Pee-wee was the referee?
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Pee-wee Anderson, was yep. that the guy's name?
Yep.
Pee-wee Anderson counts the three count, awards the belts to the Steiners. The next night, Pee-wee Anderson is forced to give the belts back to the Outsiders, saying that it wasn't a valid pin count. And then on top of that, didn't they like fire Pee-wee or whatever? And he was like, you know, oh, my family and my
kid.
Yeah,
that was the next night where Bischoff fired him. Yeah, he had the family right. kids. And then he brings the kids out and they're laughing at him. And then it was right after that, too, they did the thing where the Outsiders drove the Steiners off the road. Remember that whole thing where they ran them off the road? In the
right.
car?
Yeah, that was later. Yeah.
Yeah, but, it was like February. It was right after this.
Was when they drove Steiner, when he was forced to do the handicap match?
Yeah, pretty sure when they drove him off the road. Is
I thought that February. Was more spring. But yeah, it's fine. You could be right.
You may be right. It's in there.
Okay. So anyway, so that happens. You know what I'm going to do for this? I'm going to put the Steiners against Muto and Chono.
Okay.
You know, because I'm not just thinking like, you know, storylines. I'm thinking good matches. I want to make this a better car. And at least, you know, the Steiners have a history of performing well, and let them do kind of that New Japan style big bomb match.
February 17th was the car flipping over.
Okay. So that's what I'm going to do. I mean, do you have a problem with that?
No.
Because Chono and Muda never did anything of note there. But if you give the Steiners, Muda and Chono on a pay-per-view, maybe they can relive some of that like magic of like the Steiners just killing Japanese dudes, you know, that we got back in 91, 92.
I think okay. both years, yeah. yeah.
Right. And so that's what I would do. One of the things I think that they did right for this show, and I want to get your opinion on this, was trying to recruit DDP.
Yes,
DDP was not an outsider or was not a WWF guy. But the fact that he was a WCW guy who never went NWO in the career makes it bigger at the time. But I thought it really helped elevate DDP as a character at that time, because at the time I thought the guy was a joke.
Well, and they did a good
it
job.
It wasn't until he was able to keep throwing the diamond cutter and running through the fans and becoming like the people's champion before The Rock was the people's champion. Like, I thought they really made this guy who's really kind of hokey at heart, you know, even in his like real life, they really did kind of a great job of making him feel important.
Well, and they did a good job too with tying in why he may get recruited. Like, they kind of hinted that he's friends with Bischoff and that he had teamed with Scott Hall in the AWA. Like, that stuff was all hinted at here. And it was January 6th, so within the month we're talking about, is when he had defeated Mark Starr. And I'm looking back, I actually reviewed the whole year of 97 on my old message board back in 2007.
Okay.
So I'm pulling these up here to look at. So he had defeated Mark Starr in a match on Nitro, and that's when Hall and Nash came out. And they shake his hand, and they pretend they're going to team up. They pull out the shirt, and then Page diamond cuts Hall, and then ducks, and Nash goes flying over the top to the floor, and then he runs off through the crowd. And, like, you know, Bischoff says he's enemy number one, and this
and they're trying to harken back to that Vegas connection, right? When it was
right.
the Diamond Stud, the DDP, and then Vinny Vegas, right?
Yeah, so they tie all that together, and that's why they think it's obvious that Page is going to join, no problem, and they're buddies. And so then that's like such a big moment. That's Page's elevation to a main event act from a mid-card guy, and it was a great moment on that Nitro. And that Nitro was very important for another reason that we'll talk about in a few minutes, but I agree with you. Page, I think, should have fought Hall here. That's my pick.
Okay. I have no problem with that. I have no problem. So right now we're building the Steiners versus Chono and Muda, and then Page versus Hall, right?
Yep.
Okay. So let's look at some other guys here. What are we going to do with Kevin Nash? Because now we're taking him out of the world title picture,
yep.
or the tag title picture. Would you have Nash face the Giant?
Yeah, I think that's an option. But I think it depends on two things. Are you holding off on Savage like they did till February? And what is your thoughts on Piper? Was it important for him not to be on from between Starkey and his Super Brawl? Because that's like the big rematch at Super Brawl.
Yeah, I like Piper because Piper was a draw, right? There's no arguing that. Whatever horrible matches he had, the guy was a draw, right? He moved numbers.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
And that match really is kind of fun, the Starrcade match. It's not bad at all.
Yeah. I would actually have Piper not on the show. I would not. You know what I mean? I wouldn't. What I was thinking, and I know you've had Paige versus Hall, and I'm not even opposed to that. I wouldn't even be opposed to, like I said, I would have had Jeff Jarrett join the NWO, right? Because he's a WWF right. guy. Okay. So let's say Jarrett's part of the NWO. Paige defeats Jeff Jarrett on this show.
Okay.
Because Jeff Jarrett's credible. And then you do the whole thing where they're trying to recruit him. Because you don't want him fighting Hall and Nash yet.
Right, right.
Okay.
So you're not having had the Nitro moment happen yet? Where they try to recruit him and he turns on them? Are you waiting on that?
Yeah, or where he's kind of like
15 minutes, guys, 15.
Where he's not going to show his cards yet, you know, where he's just kind of okay, whatever. Where he doesn't do diamond cutters on him yet or anything like that,
well,
right?
Let me throw this out at you, and then I'll let you tell me where you're going to put the outsiders. But what if you do a thing where Jarrett hasn't turned yet, and you do Jarrett and Paige teaming against the outsiders, and that's where Jarrett turns. Although the strength is in Paige not turning, so maybe that doesn't work. I think you need it. That's the key. You can't have Paige get turned on. He's going to be the one refusing.
Exactly. So I just like the idea of Paige versus Jarrett because I want to defeat Jeff Jarrett. But here's what I would do with the outsiders. And like I said, I'm thinking of match quality as well as, you know, something that could have been feasible. Remember a few months later, Ric Flair and Chris Benoit had a match with the Outsiders, which was surprisingly really fun, yep. really heated, really good. Flair and Benoit are nowhere on this show. Why not? Why not have the Outsiders versus Flair and Benoit? You can do the exact same thing that happened with the Steiners, mm-hmm. right? Where, you know, you have Benoit or Flair pin Hall, because Scott Hall's not afraid to do a job, you know? Maybe do something with the belt where like Nash gets knocked out with the belt and he lays in the corner like he did for 15 minutes in that famous click tag, you know, yep. whatever, doesn't matter. But now you're going to get a really hot tag match that you can still do kind of a very similar angle, but you're putting in two of the best wrestlers the company has in the show.
What was Arn hurt yet? He was, or is he still wrestling at this point?
Arn's last match was in 96. I don't, or maybe he was hurt. I don't know. I'm still putting Flair and Benoit because okay. they're both horsemen at this time, right?
Yeah. So this is usually they'd go with Arn. So I just want to see where he was at. So he.
You like that idea?
Yeah. Oh yeah, a lot. So by the end of 96, Arn rarely competed in the ring due to years away. Okay, so he's done. I just want to make sure he's out of the picture because to me, if he's active still. Knowing WCW, they go with Flair and Arn. So he's out of the picture. Benoit's the number two now. Makes perfect sense.
All right. I like Scott Norton, you know, as a wrestler. And I want to try and maximize Scott Norton. Who do you put him against?
Let's see. You want to maximize Norton. You got Jericho.
Oh, that'd be a squash.
Yeah. Well, that's okay, though.
How about this? Is Fit Finley around or William Regal? William Regal's around.
Yeah, Regal's around. Finley, I don't think he was full time yet. He had been in and out in 96, but I don't think he's on the roster yet.
Okay. I'd actually kind of like to see Scott Norton versus William Regal. But they're both heels. But I mean Regal's a heel, right. But I mean it's NWO versus WCW, right? I mean
yeah. If we're in a vacuum, I think that's great. I don't know if they'd go with that. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, I mean, they're not going to go with any of this because they didn't do it.
That's even something. I think the other stuff we're talking about, I could maybe see. But, like, I don't see them putting Regal in that spot on this card.
Okay. So, well, because I
a month
Regal
later, he's jobbing
card.
To Prince Iaukea for the TV title.
Ah, but I want Regal on the card. Where do you put him?
It's tough because he was such a, like, bred heel. And if you look at the guys they use here, they don't really use any of those guys on the WCW side because they didn't want to make sure that the WCW guys are getting cheered. So I think you risk if you put Regal in a match here, unless he had turned face leading up to it. But if you're just picking William Regal out of where he was at the time, I don't think he fits.
That's not what I said. I said I want him on the card. Where do we put him?
He doesn't fit. Okay.
He fits.
William Regal. All right, fine. Scott Norton, William Regal.
All right.
There you go.
That's all I want.
Give you a little pleasure.
Come on, man. I'm trying to build a top shelf card here, man.
I know.
So now Big Bubba's there. Big Bubba can still go. Do you like him and Hugh Morris in a Mexican death match? Because I don't remember that match being any great shakes.
No, it doesn't really.
There's someone else. Who could we put Big Bubba against? It almost feels like if Bubba and Norton weren't both NWO, you could do Bubba Norton. That would kind of intrigue.
Yeah. Morris in the Mexican, was that like replacing Conan or something? Like, why the hell is a Mexican death match? That makes no sense. I mean, I would say Conan would be the guy, but he must have gotten hurt or something because they were both in the Dungeon of Doom and the Mexican death match thing.
Right. Yeah, that's probably what happened there. You're probably right. I think we need to investigate that.
Yeah. Damn, can you look and see if Conan was hurt at this point? I'm guessing he was.
So you know what I'm doing for that ladder match?
All right, so hang on. Conan and Bubba fought in a Mexican strap match on January 6th on Nitro. And then he was still going. He's at the Clash. Yeah.
So maybe Hugh Morris is avenging his tag buddy Conan here. Like, I don't think it was supposed to be Conan and Hugh Morris. I don't think Conan was definitely still part of the Dungeon.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So how about this? Is Haku and the Barbarian, are they both there?
Yep.
Okay, then let's do Big. How about Big Bubba versus Ming?
Yeah, that works.
You like that?
Yep.
So you kind of have like a Haas match, right?
Would you just if we have to have like Wall Street, would you make that a tag and just do the Faces of Fear versus like Bubba and Wall Street, kind of the low level NWO guys?
Yeah, I would be fine with that. I don't think it would be a better match because I think Rotundo's the drizzling shits, but
right.
We can do it.
You get Barbarian out there.
Yeah, versus Faces of Fear. I like it.
Yeah.
You know, I think maybe as long as they're beating the shit out of each other, it'd be fine.
Yeah.
You know, but that gives us three tag matches for this show. So, you know, I think we can't have any more tag matches.
No, that's it. We're tagged out.
Now, let's look at this U.S. title match. It's Eddie Guerrero versus Six in the ladder match. Do we keep this as the ladder match with Six and Eddie, or do we can we go four-way here or something?
I think I'd leave it. It's the best match on the card as it is. To me, it made Six seem like the legit upper mid-card threat. You already have your main event level guy. You have Hogan. You got your main event tag guys in Hall and Nash. You kind of need that guy that's going to go mixing it up there for the.
Still a really sloppy match, man. This is a match I watched when I was compiling stuff for the 97 yearbook. Really sloppy. Right. Not a great match. But
so who are you adding in? Because
I don't mind adding Jericho in.
All right. Well, you know? But remember, from an NWO standpoint, they're not going to put Six in there with three WCW guys, right? So he's not going to have the odds against him. So you got to either put another NWO guy in or do something along those lines because. You're not going to pick like Eddie. I mean, the easy layup would be Eddie, Jericho, right. And Dean Malenko or something, or Ultimo Dragon, you know, but you can't. NWO's not going to.
How about this? How about Hall and Nash instead of Hall and Nash? How about we do Six and Nash versus Flair Benoit and put Eddie versus Scott Hall on the ladder? Because Hall's known for those ladder matches. You're going to tell me people aren't going to tune in to see Scott Hall in a ladder match more?
If we're vacuum booking the better card, I'm with you. At the time, they didn't really split the outsiders too much.
And Eddie Guerrero at the time, and my buddy Charles always likes to point this out, Eddie Guerrero at the time, like WCW had did like a poll of like who like their most popular wrestlers were, and like Eddie Guerrero was like beating guys like Flair and Hogan, and you know. And so like... But I think Eddie Guerrero, if you want to kind of not that they wanted to make him a top guy, but I think you kind of give him credibility doing a ladder match against Scott Hall, kind of, you know, who built his name doing ladder matches.
Yeah.
And then you're able to let Six get pinned in that tag with Nash doing the Flair Benoit thing. You know?
I mean, again, if we're booking in our own world, I think it makes a lot of sense. If we're in the WCW world. The outsiders are still kind of not split.
Is better than their world.
Sure. All right. As long as we're okay, split the outsiders still at this point.
Do you like that, though? Do you like that idea?
Yeah, because I think Hall has the pedigree of the ladder match, and Eddie is you know, Eddie 97 is close to probably Sean 95. So, you know, I think it's going to give you something good and a little bit different of a dynamic. Do you have Hall win? I mean, you can't have Eddie beat Hall, right?
No, you have Hall win.
Okay.
Because I believe Six – didn't Six win this one or did
Eddie? No, Eddie won this one, but Six had stolen the belt. Remember, he carried it around.
Then how about We got two more matches we need to put on this card.
Yep.
Okay. I kind of want to put Buff Bagwell in there. I like the, like, do we do Buff versus Scotty Riggs?
Or Lex Luger, who's missing.
Lex Luger's missing? Who else is missing? Dean Malenko's missing.
Yeah, you could, Mongo from a horseman standpoint. Yeah, but still. He's one of the bigger names.
But I'm not putting Mongo on my
dream. Come on, baby.
I'm not putting him on my dream card, him and his crazy little dog.
The dog's dead. It's like Basil.
Man.
Well, Luger... Not having Luger's weird. But, all right, since we got 5 minutes, let's jump ahead and talk, like, main event. Maybe these other guys slot in.
We need the giant there. Because you know what I would rather see? I'd rather see Hulk Hogan versus Lex Luger.
Yeah, but I think they can't blow that bullet yet. Like, to me, that's a big match, and they're saving it. Like, I don't want to blow it here because Hogan's moving right back on to Piper. Savage is coming in. It's like, I feel like
Savage
Luger, Hogan
in the stands with Sting at this time?
Yes. Yeah, he and is, then a Super Bowl is when he turns.
So you can't book Savage. You can't book Sting in this.
Right. And Piper you're saving for Super Bowl.
Piper you're saving.
So you're tough. It's Hogan and Giant had the natural issue. Like I said, it was stupid that they had Giant turn and turn. And it was that January 6th night that I referenced before, DDP, was the night of the Robin Hood match. Now, you remember that whole deal?
No.
So they teased all night that Hogan and Giant were going to fight, and Hogan kept saying, I'm going to do it, you know, whatever, and Giant kept challenging him, and holy shit, we're going to get Hulk Hogan defending the title against the Giant on Nitro. Stay tuned. End of the show, main event. So they come out. We got to go for the premiere of Robin Hood on TNT. And they kept cutting into Robin Hood with bits of the match.
I do remember that.
Made it seem like the match was going on for like 40 minutes, you know, like throughout Robin Hood. If you look on, you know, back on Classics on Demand, as well as I think the network now, when you watch it, they have the whole match, and it's not good. And the NWO interferes, but it's absurd. They make it like Giant's been beating on Hogan for like a half hour when they keep cutting in through these commercials of Robin Hood. It was really, really weird and confusing, but that was like a big thing because Giant Hogan was built out well throughout the night, and there was a lot of hype for it. And I feel like if they had not interacted really, and if Giant hadn't turned and turned back, I think the match here is okay as the natural rematch from Hog Wild.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. We'll keep Hogan versus Giant.
I mean, the match sucks, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, so now we need one more match to kind of fill out this mid-card.
Yeah, I think I let Luger get a win over, like, Bagwell or something.
Okay, so Luger versus Bagwell?
Yeah, and I think Luger gets, like, some revenge on Nick Patrick, because Patrick had, you know, screwed him and Sting a couple times.
Which forces Pee Wee Anderson to come in to ref the tag match.
And then he gets fired.
Okay, so how does this card sound to you? We open up with Steiners versus Chono and Muda, kind of do that hot New Japan tag, right? Then after that, we keep the New Japan theme rolling with Scott Norton versus William Regal, okay? Then you do Bubba and Wall Street versus Faces of Fear, DDP versus Jeff Jarrett, Lex Luger versus Buff Bagwell, Six and Nash versus Flair and Benoit, Eddie Guerrero versus Scott Hall in a ladder match, and then Hulk Hogan versus the Giant as your main event.
Yep, I like it. I mean, it's clearly better than this. And then you have your hot women in your in your match.
You have to, man. I thought they should have done like the hot NWO chicks.
Do you stick with Bischoff?
I know they're going for the ironic haha, but they do.
Do you stick with Bischoff and DiBiase?
Yes. Only because it's an NWO show.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's the NWO show. And like I said at the time, I wasn't thinking, man, this is running thin. I was thinking, This is so surreal watching this crazy thing.
So I think I'd throw in like some kind of stip for Luger where like they would do it later where he wins the four-way and that's how he gets his title match. Remember, it was like him, Giant, and Harlem Heat, and Giant lets him win the match.
Right.
To get the title. So,
yeah, we didn't even put the Harlem Heat in here.
Yeah, that's okay. So maybe you do something with Luger here.
Yeah, no, I get that, but I mean, we could have done Booker T versus Buff Bagwell. As like
one minute to go.
I like Luger because I think what you do is you make Luger you know, Luger buff with the, like, title shot stipulation, and that's why they fire Pee Wee. Because, you know, it has to be some kind of title or something involved to make them so mad. So if Luger beats Buff, he gets a title match with Hogan at some point in the future. And
great
Pee Wee,
idea. Yeah,
you know,
yeah, great idea.
That's how you do
and
it.
And they're like, come on, brother Buff Bagwell, brother. We're trusting you, brother.
Right, this is your, you know, chance to shine, you know. I like that. I think we do that.
And if Buff wins, he gets a night with the winner of the pageant.
There you go. Yes. Or Luger's wife for a month. So there you go. Future Totally Buff or whatever their name was later on. No, I think it's a good card. It's an interesting month. And we didn't really get into the whole month, but you had the Savage stuff with Sting, like you said. Nitro was a big deal. Obviously, the Robin Hood match, the DDP thing. Just a lot going on in those Nitros. And I'm going to give the old message board a plug for the first time in forever. Bigelow34.proboards.com. About probably 6 years ago, reviewed every Nitro from 97. So you can go back and relive those if you want. See my thoughts on the grades.
And that's time, guys. Time is
up. We get some final thoughts. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. Let's keep this show rolling.
NWO Sting, by the way, is the other guy we could have used. We didn't. NWO Sting.
Yeah, whatever.
Jeff Farmer. All right, Dan, why don't we, before we get to mail, quickly, PlaceHumanation.com, lots going on. Be sure to check out our ever-growing, award-winning podcast network. We have Exile on Bass Street. We have Between the Sheets. We have the original Mothership, the Place to Be podcast. We have our monthly reaction shows with good old Will here leading a crew. We have the Kevin Kelly Show. We have Main Event, which is returning here in the new year, along with Sports Evolution, the NBA Team podcast, TJ McClune Show, everything you could want. And I apologize to the ones I didn't mention there. Titans of Wrestling, of course, where the big boys play, Chad and Parv, another one of the originals. Let's see, what am I missing here?
Come on, let's move on.
Well, I'm just trying to plug them, you know, Pro Wrestling Super Show, all the ones, Super Extreme Vault. Just want to let everyone know of the quality of show we have here at Placement Nation. Be sure to visit us each and every day. We have great material, ongoing series, one-off articles, pay-per-view previews, Raw recaps, everything you could want. Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation, Twitter, Place2BNation. And remember to click that Amazon link. Even though Christmas is over, we all know you're still out there shopping. Click the link on the side of the page before you go to Amazon, and it kicks back some cash over to us. So with that said, Dan McGinn, what do you say we do 7 minutes of mail beginning right about now?
We're going to the party. We're going to the game. We're going to the disco. We're going to cruise out, man. We're stealing people's mail. Stealing people's mail.
You've got mail.
Okay, guys, you know, politics is in the air right now, presidential election in the new year, but, you know, guys are dropping like flies, but I have a candidate for you. If Hulk Hogan ran for president in 2000, like he talked about, who would have been his running mate? Also, what would have been his main campaign promises? This comes from a listener named Grimace.
We all know Grimace is Stephen Graham. I don't know why he's so interested in American politics. I'm surprised he didn't ask who the stupid Prime Minister of Canada would be or whatever.
Leave him alone. Leave him alone.
Screw him. Hogan, 2000, of course, is when he had announced his retirement. Was it in late 98 that he's going to run for president? And then they did the finger poke and he didn't. So what do you think, Will? Who stands out here as potential running mates besides Ed Leslie?
A Roddy Piper?
A Hogan Piper ticket?
Dude, I have no idea. Piper's Canadian. I guess he'd be disqualified.
Bischoff? I think Bischoff's a natural.
Well, I think Hogan and Bischoff actually probably had, like, really different politics. True. You know what I mean? Bischoff, hardcore conservative, him and Scott Bell. Now, I could see Bischoff and Scott Bell running as, like, your hardcore righteous right candidates. But Hogan, I think, is more of a don't make me pay taxes. But, you know, I'm going to pretend I'm a social liberal guy, even though we know he's kind of like a closet racist.
Well, maybe if they didn't hate each other's guts, a Ventura Hogan ticket could have ruffled some feathers, you know.
I think Ventura was too serious of a guy back then. Weird as that sounds, he really was. He was a legitimate, you know, politician.
The ticket, I'm curious if it could have worked because I think they had some momentum. Is the one he teased, him and Trump, I think, in, like, the 2000s.
That would have absolutely been no shock at all.
right?
Absolutely, I mean, would have been a realistic ticket.
I think so. Like, Jesse was hot off the governor thing and still kind of not crazy, and Trump hadn't gone completely batshit yet with the Rosie O'Donnell stuff and everything else. So it's like, I don't know. I think in like 04, that ticket could have maybe made a little noise.
Yeah, I think you found it, the right guy. Donald Trump, I hate everybody who isn't white.
And him and Jesse. Would you have Jesse to me would be the president?
No, Jesse's too outsider. He's too independent.
So you're going to make Trump the president and Jesse the running mate?
No, Hogan and Trump.
Oh, you want Hogan and Trump? I'm talking Jesse and Trump.
No, man. Hogan and Trump would have been an ideal ticket.
Yeah.
There's no way. Jesse would have like some general or something, or you know what I mean? Kind of like Perot did. You know what I mean? You remember when Perot had like that admiral or something? This guy, that guy who fell asleep during the debates.
If you're Trump Hogan, then Trump's your president. Hogan's your VP. I mean, that makes more sense to me than Hogan being president.
But Hogan's the guy running for president.
I know.
I believe it was Admiral Akbar, right, who was running with the Ross Perot?
There you go. Yeah, absolutely.
Guys, would your answer change much if it was Bob Backlund who would be on his ticket? I'd pick the Iron Sheik myself.
There you go. Yes, Backlund and Sheik. Arnold Scarlin will be the one falling asleep at the podium.
Yeah, I have no idea. Bob Backlund, is he a really hardcore right guy? I don't know.
I don't know. He's out of his fucking mind. That's all I know.
Oh, there's another F-ball.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's already done.
That's gone.
Are we starting again for 2016? Am I one in the hole?
No, I'm not buying another deal. It's done. But
guys,
you get
any more for the presidency for
wrestling? Let's move on. We spent way too much time on this question.
Danish Dynamite writes, sometime during a drunken binge in 85 and 86, Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, and Barry Windham drive a truck full of cocaine and steroids through a window of a Burger King while screaming the N-word and stabbing each other with scissors. They're now banned from the business. Who now takes their places?
Who are the four? Hogan, Savage, Flair, and...
Barry Windham.
And what year is this? Wait, do we have a year?
85, 86.
Oh, man, that's hard. Ted DiBiase.
Who's spot?
He's one.
Who does he take? Whose spot?
Well, I mean, Flair. He's going to be your next NWA champion.
Let's make sure on the same page.
I'd put Jerry Lawler there, but you know, that's just me. Well, who would you put?
No, I know. I'm just busting you up because you're going to work them into every conversation.
Of course. Dude, if we just did Jerry Lawler Appreciation Podcast, I'd be perfectly happy with that.
Barry Windham's a weird one. Who would take Barry Windham's spot in 85, 86? I mean, he was just coming off the U.S. Express. What was he, back in Florida? I mean, I think Luger slots right in for Windham, right? Kind of the same track. Comes
yeah,
up in 87.
Sure.
I mean, I think
it's past Luger is a good choice for that time period.
Yeah, I'd go Luger over Windham. So Savage is the interesting one. I see Champ, getting groomed eventually for the world title.
Do Steamboat.
Yeah, but Savage, heel Savage, Steamboat, you need the heel in 85, 86, because that sets up the epic face run when he kind of earns the respect of the fans and turns because of the feud with Steamboat. You know what I mean?
We could do Jake the Snake, because he could be interchangeable.
I think Jake's the guy. Yeah.
But then he's going to run through a Wendy's with a truck full of crack cocaine. So
him as well. So you're putting Lawler in for Hogan? Is that what you're saying?
I would put Lawler in for everybody. You know, why not? Lawler, I mean, it doesn't have to be a one-for-one deal. I mean, we're just looking at kind of like your four faces of wrestling here. I definitely put, I think, Lawler, Jake.
I put Piper. Piper turns face and doesn't leave for the movies.
You know what? The guy's popular. I don't see why not. Put Piper in there. So we do Lawler, Piper, Luger, and who's the other one? DiBiase.
Yeah.
I like it.
Okay. And Jake. Five guys. We're replacing those. Hogan needs two guys to replace him. Lawler and Piper.
Yeah, there you go. Sure. Why not?
All right, one more, Dan.
One more fun one, guys. This one coming from Loss. He had this conversation with a guy named Tom Kay over Twitter about this. Think of as many ECW-turned-York Foundation members' new gimmick names as possible.
Do what?
All right, so take somebody from ECW and give them their names as if they were if they were in the York Foundation. So Richard Morton or...
Well, the ones he gives are examples are Robert Van Dam, Christopher Chetty, Rhinoceros, Daniel Torrank.
Kid Cash is like self-explanatory.
What, Man Cash?
You could do Man Cash. No, I was thinking just Kid Cash.
The one I'm trying to really come up with is Taz. What can we do? Taz to me is like the home run if we can hit it here.
I don't know, dude. I'm not good with word games.
Probably like Zach, like Tazzery.
I'm trying to think like Sandman. What's Sandman's name? Hack, right?
Jim Fillington. Sorry, it's just, how about James Sandman?
James.
James Sandman.
What would be Balls Mahoney's name in the York?
Testicles. That's obvious.
Oh, yeah, definitely testicles.
Gonads Mahoney.
Gonads Mahoney. Ian Rotten would be... what, or Axel Rotten? I mean, how could you do the Rottens?
Yeah, Axel.
Alex?
Yeah, Alex, I guess. Alex,
Steve Carino would be Stefan Carino.
Yeah, Stefan, that's an easy one.
I know, dude, I'm dying.
A Raven. Raven that Simone. <That'd> be...
Well, he's Scotty, right? So.
Right, yeah. Scott Fallonieu.
All right, guys.
This game
seemed
a lot more fun, but I think you used all the good ones. Rhinoceros isn't going to be top, so I mean that's where we top off.
All right, guys, time's up on this one.
Boy, all right, another fun episode in the books, guys. Thank you as always for joining us. And thanks everyone for listening and all your great feedback. We appreciate it. Whether you love or hate Ronnie Garvin, we appreciate you taking the time to check in and give us that feedback here at the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. Be sure to come back every 2 weeks. We're here. For you, usually on a Wednesday night, sometimes a different night, but usually every 2 weeks you can find us, PlaySimulation.com. So, for Dan McGinn, for Daniel McGinn, for good old William from Texas, I am good old Justinius, and we are out of here. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Everyone take care. And all I can breathe is your life, and sooner or later it's over. I just don't want to miss you. And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't think that they'd understand. When everything's made to be broken, I just want you to know who I am. Tears that ain't coming, all the moment the truth in your lies. When everything feels like the movies, yeah, you bleed just to know you're alive.